is Wednesday, August 26, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Asian stocks fluctuate despite China's interest rate cut. VOA correspondent Sharon Bain looks at efforts in Iraq to battle ISIS.
Iraqi Peshmerga are currently trying to keep roughly a 1,500-kilometer border against ISIS. They have it manned all along that border, and they push back constantly.
And we'll hear selections from pop diva Rita Ora's new album. It's all ahead. China's benchmark Shanghai Index continued to lose ground Wednesday, falling another 1.25%. It raised its 3 days of losses to nearly 18% despite the government's stimulus efforts. China's central bank Tuesday cut a key interest rate, the fifth since November, and reduced the amount of cash banks must hold in reserve. Japanese, South Korean, and Australian markets advanced, but Hong Kong lost ground Wednesday. Scott Kennedy, a China economic expert at the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, as long as there are global concerns about China's economy, the world's second largest, he expects further intervention by Beijing. Kennedy says Chinese policymakers must give clearer signals about the direction they intend to go. He says that uncertainty is what's driving much of the concern about China.
I think that they're torn between two challenges. The first is the short-term worry of growth slowing down, which is self-induced because they underwent an austerity campaign because there was too much investment in real estate, and they undertook an anti-corruption campaign because there was so much corruption. Both of those things have slowed down the economy, and they need to get the economy moving. The other challenge they have is restructuring the economy for long-term growth, and that requires some very hard choices and reforms to open up the economy to private and foreign companies, liberalize in a variety of different areas. And that's something that is difficult to do very quickly. It unleashes a lot of challenges, puts state-owned enterprises on the defensive, which are the children of the Communist Party, essentially. So they are trying to deal with both of those. And by walking that fine line, in some ways, they're making mistakes in both the short term and the long term. So they need a lot of help to get out of this jam.
A quote from Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott, whose country is heavily exposed to China. I think it's important people don't hyperventilate about these types of things. It's not unusual to see stock market corrections. It is not unusual to see the bubbles burst in particular markets and for there to be some flow-on effect in other stock markets, but the fundamentals are sound.
That's a wonderful statement of fact, but it's also true that the Chinese have made some missteps in how they've managed the stock market. They intervened dramatically in early July and spent over 1.5 trillion renminbi to do so with no good effect and hurt their credibility. And they loosened the peg of the renminbi to the dollar earlier this month without giving a clear explanation of why. Growth is slowing. They had the accident in Tianjin that left over 100 dead and no one clearly to take the blame. So I think there's worries not just about the direction of the economy, but the quality and capacity of the leadership to guide it through troubling times. I think even though we've always been worried about human rights in China, about China's assertiveness on the global stage, we always thought that these folks knew how to run an economy, even if they didn't do it according to the logic that we said. But now they're raising real doubts about their capacity to do so. And until they prove that they are good stewards of their economy again, I think you're going to continue to see concerns raised elsewhere. They may be more than Australians want, given how closely they're tied to the economy. But they are well-deserved, and the Chinese need to step up and show that they can manage their economy because it does have implications for everybody.
Reuters says that a majority of analysts predict a continued deceleration, not a crash, for China's economy, and dismiss comparisons with the 08 global financial crisis or the 97-98 crisis in Asia.
I think the Chinese have enough renminbi and enough dollars on hand that they can avoid an Asian financial crisis or the global financial crisis. Money is leaking out of China. It's not running out of China. At the same time, they also do have some good fundamentals over the long term. They just need to marry those good fundamentals to quality policy to reassure markets, reassure governments elsewhere, and then they have a very good chance of getting through this. But it's a big concern, and you know, we will just have to wait and see if they're up to the task.
That's Scott Kennedy of the Centers for Strategic and International Studies. Well, he says Beijing will unlikely meet its target growth rate of 7% this year. He believes it can weather this crisis if it can rein in debt, liberalize the state sector, and allow more competition. And Kennedy says the U.S. market's recent wild swings have as much to do with the domestic U.S. economy, global growth, and the world's trouble spots as current events in Beijing. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's the reaction to all this?
Well, the reaction yesterday was we had on Monday hashtag Black Monday. Then we had hashtag Turnaround Tuesday, because as the day was progressing, as the markets opened yesterday here in the U.S. and in Europe, they were actually up. They were giving back some of those losses, and they were gaining. Unfortunately, the turnaround was shortly lived, as people noted on social media, because by the end of the day, the Dow again was down about 200 points or so. So we're seeing these kind of daily hashtags. So I don't know if today will be hashtag woeful Wednesday or hashtag wonderful Wednesday, but we'll see. And this was something we talked about extensively on our show, hashtag VOA.
Yes.
So I invite our users, our viewers to check it out, voanews.com/hashtag VOA. We talked a lot about the social media elements and the reaction there. Here in the U.S., sad news, Marcy Borders. There's this iconic photo of her covered in dust after the 9/11 attacks. It's one of the iconic photos of the attacks. And she's passed away after a cancer battle. She had stomach cancer. And a lot of questions on social media about if this cancer is linked to the attacks. There are a lot of first responders to the 9/11 attacks who had lung cancer and other issues because of all the dust and pollutants in the air. So people questioning that on social media, mourning her loss in that iconic photo. Moving on, Julius Yago. He's a Kenyan athlete at the World Athletic Championships in Beijing. He is a javelin thrower. He has thrown the third longest javelin throw of all time, the longest in 14 years. And here's the amazing thing that people are pointing out on social media and the reason why he's trending. He learned how to throw the javelin by watching YouTube videos.
Good for him.
If you can believe that. So amazing for him. He's doing quite well. So it shows that YouTube can be a great resource for sure.
Absolutely.
A learning tool. We also have trending this morning McDonald's and Burger King. They want to make a McWhopper. They want to combine the Big Mac and the Whopper, the two restaurants' iconic burgers.
Who would have thought that?
Who would have thought? Well, apparently it's for the UN, I guess, World Day of Peace they're doing on September 21st. They say, okay, let's make peace between our two headquarters in Chicago and Miami. We want to open a store in Atlanta, in the pop-up store in a parking lot, and make a McWhopper and combine our two employees from the stores nearby and have this kind of peacemaking. So I'm sure there's going to get a lot of attention as that approaches. People, I'm sure, lining up to get those as those come out. And then finally, I can't get out without mentioning trending not just in the U.S. but worldwide today, hashtag National Dog Day. So everyone posting pictures of their dogs. I'm about to go post some pictures of mine up on social media. People also saying, it's National Dog Day, but for the other 364 days a year, it's National Cat Day. And some funny pictures of cats, you know, harassing dogs. So a little battle back and forth on social media about that this morning.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Well, in other news, a Russian military court Tuesday sentenced acclaimed Ukrainian film director Oleh Sentsov to 20 years in prison on charges of leading a terrorist group in Crimea. Rights groups say the case shows every sign of being a politically motivated show trial because of his opposition to Russia's occupation of Crimea. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Moscow.
A military court in Rostov-on-Don found Oleg Sentsov guilty of leading a terrorist group and terrorist attacks on pro-Russia organizations in Crimea. Co-defendant Oleksandr Kolchenko was also convicted of terrorism and sentenced to 10 years. Rights groups expected a guilty verdict in the highly politicized trial. Heather McGill is a researcher in Amnesty International's Eurasia program.
The various violations of fair trial standards point to the fact that these accusations are possibly fabricated for political reasons.
Russia's FSB, the successor to the Soviet KGB, arrested Sentsov in May 2014 at a pro-Ukraine rally in Crimea. Russia had annexed the Black Sea Peninsula from Ukraine just 2 months earlier. Russian authorities allege Sentsov was armed and that he and three others who were arrested were plotting to blow up a statue of Russian communist revolutionary Vladimir Lenin. They also allege Sentsov was behind efforts to burn down two Russia-related organizations. The defendants were accused of being members of a right-wing Ukrainian group and, despite being Ukrainian citizens, taken to Russia for trial, notes McGill.
The fact that they were transported from the occupied territory of Crimea to Russia to face trial under Russian law is actually a violation of international humanitarian law.
The testimony of one of the arrested men was used as the basis of most of the evidence against Sentsov. That defendant pled guilty, along with another, and both were sentenced to 7 years in prison. Earlier this month, however, the main witness recanted his testimony, alleging it was given only after he was tortured. Sentsov denied the charges and said he was also beaten in detention. Russian authorities claim Sentsov's injuries were caused by his preference for rough sex. The Ukrainian director is best known for his 2011 film Gamer, about a teenage computer games champion. International filmmakers have called for his release. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Early in its history, the moon rocked with volcanism. Volcanoes blasted streams of magma high above the lunar surface in eruptions known as fire fountains. To power these explosive eruptions, the magma needs to mix with volatile chemicals and chemical compounds. In a study published by the journal Nature Geoscience, the researchers say the ancient lunar fire fountains were driven by considerable amounts of carbon dioxide gas. The researchers found that the lava from deep inside the moon was rich in carbon and, as it rose toward the lunar surface, mixed with oxygen to create the supply of CO2. To make their findings, the scientists carefully analyzed glass beads that had been brought back from the moon decades ago on the Apollo 15 and 17 missions. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear the latest sounds from singer Rita Ora. VOA correspondent Sharon Bain is in Erbil, Iraq, where she's been doing some reporting on the ground there. Sharon, what are the Peshmerga doing as far as trying to combat ISIS?
Well, the Peshmerga in Kurdistan, so the Iraqi Peshmerga, are currently trying to keep roughly a 1,500-kilometer border against ISIS. They have it manned all along that border, and they push back constantly. There is back-and-forth shelling. There's back-and-forth shooting. Some areas are worse than others. I actually went to one of the frontline posts and talked to them there, and they told me that, you know, there is always a sporadic pushing, but they push back, and that they've learned how to counter IS or Islamic State tactics. I think what's interesting here is that the overwhelming nationalist Kurdish fervor against ISIS. There is absolutely not one person that I've spoken to who is not ready to take up a gun and shoot them. And that includes Peshmerga women, whom I've spoken to and said, you know, we will defend, you know, Kurdish land until the death. Even today I did an interview in the office of the vice president with a very nicely dressed young man. And he said, yeah, I asked him about last year. And he said, last year I was on the front line with my brothers fighting alongside the Peshmerga. There's just a really strong sort of nationalist attitude against ISIS. They will fight to keep them out of Kurdish, what they believe is Kurdish land.
Now, I believe you've also spoken with some Sunni tribal leaders. How do they view a way to reach a solution with ISIS?
The Sunni tribal leaders were actually a very interesting thing. They were hard to reach. It took a lot of organization to try to get them to speak to me. There are several layers of Sunni tribal leaders. There's a sort of senior layer, and they tend to live in Amman and other countries other than Iraq. I was speaking to sort of the top third underneath the senior leaders and asking them what they thought. They're not unified. I think I need to say that right off the top. Even the five that I spoke to were not unified, and there was recently a conference of just Anbar tribal leaders in Baghdad that ended up with them throwing chairs at each other. There is really no unity among the tribal leaders. But the ones that I spoke to, the common threads were, that the Sunnis want political rights. They feel that the recent governments in Iraq have been very sectarian, very pro-Iran and Shia, and that they have been squeezed out of the political arena completely and that they have no rights. The other sort of common thread is, you know, we want the U.S. to guarantee our safety if we are to take up arms against ISIS. They have not, you know, there has been no really consistent across-tribal movement. There have been some tribes which have taken up arms and their families have been massacred. So there has been no overwhelming, sort of pan-Sunni movement to counter ISIS. When I asked them, you know, you want weapons, who would anybody give them to? Because there is no unified structure. The answer is just give us weapons and, you know, we'll resolve it. And it's really hard to tell how they would do that. They have done it before. The Sunni leaders have risen up against Al-Qaeda, which was the forerunner to ISIS, and they have managed to squeeze them out before. But there doesn't seem to be a lot. Right now, they don't seem to be in a position of power.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Sharon.
You're very welcome.
Okay. That's VOA's correspondent Sharon Bain reporting from Erbil, Iraq. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. British pop diva Rita Ora has a new CD coming out and a new song called Body on Me. It also features Chris Brown. International Edition colleague David Byrd spoke with VOA Border Crossings host Larry London about the latest musical endeavor.
Maybe you know her from The X Factor in Britain. Maybe you know her from her Oscar-nominated performance. But Rita Ora is lighting up the pop charts with her new song and her new record. Larry, Rita is, she's got a long list of accomplishments.
Oh, yeah.
Not just pop music.
She's pretty hot right now, with, of course, judging on the TV show and endorsing all of these very well-known name brands throughout the UK. She's had, believe it or not, 6 top 5 hits. And of those, she's had 4 number ones in the UK. And she currently recorded a brand new duet with Chris Brown. The video came out this week. Her tour started in the U.S. this week. So she's been very, very busy here in America.
Now, did she write this song that we're talking about? Or is this a written by somebody else and she's just singing?
Well, it was, I don't know who wrote it, but the song is directed by Colin Tilley, who has worked with Justin Timberlake and Kendrick Lamar, the video. And the song will appear on her upcoming new album. It doesn't say anywhere whether she wrote it or co-wrote it or had anything to do. She's not known for her writing skills. But she, of course, was nominated for a Billboard Award, Grammy Award with Iggy Azalea for Black Widow. Song from a year ago, and she's making a splash here in America. She's well established in the UK, but she's trying to get that same traction here in the US.
And now fans also, she's not hard to look at.
Not at
all. She's a very attractive young woman. She's got a tour going on. Where are some of the stops on her tour?
Well, the tour begins this week here in the United States, San Francisco. Los Angeles, then Santa Ana, California, Las Vegas, Atlanta, Georgia, Boston, Massachusetts, here in Washington, D.C., in the middle of September. And hopefully I'll get her on Border Crossings.
Well, that'd be great. That'd be fantastic. Well, if you have any comments about Rita Ora's latest single, the title of which is?
It's Body on Me.
The title of it is Body on Me. If you have any comments about that, you can send us a tweet. We're at VOAIE. You can also listen for Larry's program, Border Crossings, on our website. That's www.voanews.com.
Baby, let's cut down the lights. I just really want to let this fire burn bright. I'm just telling you to have an open mind. Just barely touching, so do it again, so do it again. We could be on to something. Hey, oh, hey, oh, I just wanna feel your body on me. Hey, oh, hey, oh, if you want it, then you got it for me. No more, no more wasted.
That is the music of singer Rita Ora, who's becoming very popular, particularly here in the United States. Well, please visit our website. It's at voanews.com. We have a range of stories that might interest you from all over the world, as well as from here in the U.S. That's our show for today. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 18th, 82-year-old Khaled al-Assad, a prominent Syrian archaeologist and the head of antiquities for the ancient city of Palmyra for more than 40 years, was brutally murdered by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. In May 2015, ISIL seized control of Tadmor, which contains the historic ruins of the ancient city of Palmyra. Despite the danger that prevailed with ISIL's previous murderous acts and destruction of other cultural heritage sites, al-Assad remained in the city to protect its treasures and helped evacuate the city museum prior to ISIL's takeover. The United States condemns in the strongest possible terms this murder of a man who dedicated his life to preserving Syria's cultural treasures, said U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby. Like so many of ISIL's victims, his life and extraordinary work stand in stark contrast to that of his barbaric killers, he said. These attempts to erase Syria's rich history will ultimately fail. ISIL's damage and looting of historic sites in Syria and Iraq, which have been preserved for millennia, have not only destroyed irreplaceable evidence of ancient life and society, but have also helped fund its reign of terror inside those countries. Mr. Kirby said, as we respond to the brutality and suffering ISIL inflicts on the Syrian and Iraqi people, we continue to urge all parties in both countries and in the international community to deprive ISIL of this funding stream by rejecting the trafficking and sale of looted artifacts. All those who destroy important cultural property must be held accountable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage. at www.voanews.com/editorials.